Welcome to What in the World, the podcast where we talk about all kinds of stuff, generally esoteric. My name is Ayama Natara. I have with me Dave Burke.
Hello.
And we're still stuck in the apocalypse here in Los Angeles. What you got for me today, Dave?
Stupid apocalypses, man. They just don't get over and done with real quick, do they?
Speaking of doing easy things like we talked about in the last episode, it'd be nice if this were easier and quicker.
Right? But we don't learn. So, hey, we gotta go through things the hard way. Okay, so I am going to preface this by saying I did not read this article at all. I just read the headline and thought that this would be cool. So we've talked about, we've spoken about in the past, different perceptions, and along with that goes, different languages and having to learn how to communicate, all that sort of thing. So I was over on phys.org, and just the title kind of caught my eye, and it is mathematics real? And kind of thing is a viral TikTok video raises a legitimate question with answers. So I didn't, like I said, I don't know the exciting answers because I didn't read the article, but just the concept of questioning whether or not mathematics is real. I read like the very beginning of it. Basically, some people are arguing that mathematics, as we know them, is not a universal language. Whereas, in the movies and with other people, they're like, oh, it's absolutely a universal language because it's, we know that physics, as we know it, is not immutable because because we're generating it and we're having to learn new things all the time, and then we kind of have to make the math fit what we see to suit your observation, which kind of reveals a flaw in the way that we may be thinking about math. But we've also said that math and therefore music are types of languages, right? Because musical definitely has a mathematical component, the way we perceive and compose it. So it gets my brain to going, how much of math is us doing baby talk, for lack of a better term, and we'll figure out how to speak like the adults?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you said a number of things that pinged for me. Thank you.
Oh, good.
math is language in our reality, in our perception. If you want to go back even further into what you started saying, and the title of the article is Math Real? Is anything real? I'm a shaman. This is all dreaming, Math is a language in our shared perception. Music is a better way. Well, no, math is a good way to look at this too. Okay, I've got too much stuff going on. Let me sort this
Right.
out. Based on where you're from in the world, on this planet, and what your cultural understanding is, math is different, and they use different musical scales. So it is absolutely a language based on a shared perception. We're operating in base 10 and base 12,
Right.
because we can't make up our goddamn minds. But you've got it's derived from Sumerian, where they're operating on base 60, which is 12 times 5, which is half of 10. And I'm starting to sound like one of those, crazy number people. But why don't we operate from base 20? I've got 10 fingers and 10 toes. I could be, doubling that. There are a lot of cultures out there where, once you get past three, it's just many. And in the base 10 system, because that's what we use for, like, say, money, once you get past a certain point, once you get into like billion, it is not conceivable to the human mind as it currently exists within the society that's talking about it. We can kind of perceive like millions. Once you get into billions, it might as well be many. It might as well be a bazillion. So when you move into other dimensional space and other dimensional understanding. You know, math is, you know, baby talk, or even just sort of simplistic, uncivilized, whatever. The challenge is really that at this dimension, we seem to be stuck in communication and language as a verbal thing. You know, language started on this planet as a form of magic, of spell casting. You know, it was not intended for communication. Communication is energetic. It's third chakra to, or third eye to third eye kind of stuff. But once you drop the energy down, we have to use words to get concepts across. And it's really imprecise, which is why at our level, math is a much better language because it's more precise.
True.
And music, because it's more precise. And music, you can actually float understanding on a lot better than you can with math, because most people don't understand it. Or, you know, talkie-talkie language, because again, it's imprecise. There are languages other than English that are more precise. English is an especially imprecise language, probably because it's a mishmash of a bunch of stuff. So yeah, it's relational. And once you get to a certain point, it's more about thinking about it or projecting your thoughts, or not even your thoughts so much as data. And data is different than your thought. It can be data about my experience. But, you know, once you get to that point, you've got sort of a transpersonal memory going on anyway. So,
Right. And music as a mode of communication taps into multiple levels of perception.
Yes.
Yeah.
And is more likely to generate a uniform chemical response within the body than language is.
Right. But it's still kind of muddy in that it kind of depends on a cultural reference point for sure. A lot of the emotions it evokes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, somebody from the West using music to communicate with someone from, you know, Eastern Asia isn't going to work particularly well, because they are still to this day much more keyed into a different scale, a different way of using music as language. And so just like, you know, Mandarin is not super easy for an English speaker to learn, you know, that musical language is also losing stuff in translation.
Right. And just never forget that Lick My Love Pump is to be played in D minor. For those who like a little Spinal Tap reference, but that's okay. All right, so kind of along with that, there's a study being done, and I have a major flaw with this study in that they're operating, I think, off of incomplete data. But they've a small team of, I don't know if they're scientists or acoustical engineers, I forget, but they're just calling them trio of researchers. They reconstructed a complete Stonehenge and shot it through with some sound waves, and they came up with some interesting things. Now, what they did is they had 3D models made, and then, you know, they basically closed the circle, so all the menhirs had their proper tops, and they were all connected, and they had the structures all done and placed. So the result was pretty interesting in that they found that the time of decay to 60 decibels was more than a half second inside the monument, but not. So the acoustical properties actually played with sound and how it sustained. So when you're inside, inside the circle, you're having a much more sustained and maybe a fuller experience maybe than those who are standing outside.
Now, I have a question. Did they experiment with different types of sound waves? Because Stonehenge reconstructed is absolutely going to respond to vocal tones much more than anything else.
So the testing consisted of playing chirping noises that ran the gamut from very low to very high frequencies. So they played with frequencies, but it doesn't look like they played with any kind of transitions, which that would be the next step for me. It was like, you know, they just hit it at a certain frequency and pulses, and then they worked their way up the, the frequencies.
Which, from a science point of view, is really the way to do it. But different qualities of tone are going to produce different results, and they're actually going to have a much marked, stronger result off of doing vocal tones, because that's what it was constructed for.
Right. And they're coming at it from a very science and techie perspective, because they don't even talk about the astronomical theory of one of the purposes of Stonehenge as an observatory. They just talk about it as they say that they don't believe Stonehenge was constructed purely for its acoustical properties. And then they just go on to say, work by other researchers has shown that it was most likely used for such things as ritual burials. And that's where they kind of leave it. So, So all the theoretical purposes that people have proposed have been kind of left by the wayside.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's acoustical stuff there. There's also astrological stuff there for sure. But what it was used for most often, I mean, it's a sacred space. And so because it holds resonance more strongly, it's a really good place for ritual. They didn't do burials there. They may very well have done energetic, we're sending our dead on, you know, the folks who have left their bodies, but it had nothing to do with the bodies themselves. But in general, it was used for manifestation, for weather shifting. That's interesting. I hadn't gotten that one before, but for weather shifting and stuff like that. And a lot of it was done with vocal tone. And because it's sacred space, it was where they collected data as well. So having astronomical observations being able to be done there makes that useful. But it's absolutely a resonance chamber, you know, and if sound sustains longer, energy is going to sustain longer. It's really good for manifestation, for changing energy, stuff like that.
Right. And so what do you think, or how do you think ley lines play into that sort of combination of purposes?
I mean, ley lines is such a huge topic. Ley lines, for people who don't know, are sort of the meridian lines of the planet. Unlike the meridian lines, well, I don't know. I don't know if anyone's ever tried to do energetic shifting of meridian lines within the human body. But one of the things that dowsers can do is that we can move ley lines. We can shift them slightly if they're inconveniently placed, or if we need to find water or something like that. Where you have three ley lines or more crossing, you're going to have automatic earth-generated, natural, innate sacred space because they're energetic lines. And so you have a power point at that location. It also usually produces a water mound or a natural spring. It's a really good place to drill for water. But if it's a sacred space, you've got better things to do there than look for water, unless you live in the desert. There's a lot of, especially in like the British Isles, there's a lot of sacred spaces that are absolutely places where you go and get water too. They're called sacred wells, and it's a big cultural thing within the Celts. How does Stonehenge relate to or be affected by ley lines? If I remember correctly, there's a convergence of like three or four ley lines in that space.
Yeah. They're pretty big vortex, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it's on the ley line, if memory serves, that connects to like Angkor Wat and maybe either the Angkor Wat or the pyramids.
I mean, it's on one of the ley lines that goes through it is absolutely the one that goes all the way out to Dover and then through the channel. And I think that one goes through Shout as well. where the last remaining labyrinth from the Middle Ages is in France. How do ley lines affect that? Well, it helps make it sacred space. I mean, it historically, you know, pre white man deciding that they can, you know, impose their will on nature, sacred space, you know, manufactured sacred space was usually built on pre-existing innate sacred space, because why not? You know, you're trying to imbue power into what it is you're doing. Why not plug it into the electrical socket, you know? And, you know, interestingly enough, whether they realized it or not, or whether they were going for a different purpose or not, a lot of the colonizing sacred space, i.e. cathedrals, were then built on top of those. Right. So they were co-opting the innate sacred space, whether they realized it or not. You know, it would be a fun experiment to take some of the ley lines in that area that don't go through and make them go through, or, you know, convince them to go through. It's really more of a conversation.
Right.
Just to see what changes.
Okay, let's do it.
I would probably need to get, just because there's so much power going on in that space, I would probably need to get several dowsers to buy into this and do it with me.
I believe in you.
In a pinch, in case anybody's wondering, a pulse oximeter works really well as a pendulum, as long as it has a lanyard on it. All right, we got one more going through. That's fun. Of course, it would help if there was someone there who could then, you know, tell me what the result is.
Right. So I'm looking at a really quick and dirty map of ley lines, and I'm not seeing a connection to Angkor Wat, Egypt, but it does go through, apparently it connects the second and fourth planet chakras. Okay. And the second chakra is in Lake Titicaca.
Okay. Peru.
Or is that Bolivia? Peru. It's one of those two.
They believe it's on the border, but I usually associate it with Peru.
Yeah, it's Bolivia, technically, I think. Because that's I don't want to give too much, because I actually started writing this stuff down before the show, but it's in the province of Tiwanaku, or Tiwanaku, however you want to say it.
Well, I always associate like Titicaca with the energy formation that exists around Machu Picchu.
It's also part of that district, Machu Picchu.
Okay. Yeah, you know, one of the interesting things is that generally when there's a strong power source like Machu Picchu, like Stonehenge, it's usually not, here is this one point, you know. There's usually sort of a power structure or a power dome that exists that covers that and other stuff. You know, and there's a bunch of sacred sites and burial mounds and stuff in the vicinity of Stonehenge, for sure. You know, the reason that you've got Lake Titicaca associated with Machu Picchu is because, well, from a cultural point of view, the mountains are Mother Earth. It's Pachamama. And so Machu Picchu is sort of the feminine aspect or PowerPoint or anchor for that energetic space, that sacred space. And Lake Titicaca is the masculine principle, and you have sort of a polarity going between the two. Do we happen to know, you have a map in front of you, I'm sure, do we happen to know what is in between those two spaces? What is like approximate center?
We do, but I don't want to go into it because that's actually what I had my notes on for another subject.
Okay, so apparently I'm tapping into whatever that is.
Yeah, so stop. Sorry. Cut it out.
We'll come back to it like some other episode, I guess.
Yes.
Fine.
We have notes. We're okay.
Cliffhanger for the listeners. All right, so going back to Stonehenge. Isn't Dover, so there's that one ley line that goes through there. Isn't Dover where there's that horse ground image?
Oh yeah, the I'm blanking on what to call them. It's not a henge. It's and it's not a petroglyph. It's some. It's a something glyph, and I'm blanking on it so bad.
Hopefully, a listener is getting angry and will email us about
probably,
it.
Probably, because they're just like, you're so stupid. It's just this. Wikipedia just says hill figure. Thanks, Wikipedia. Yeah, isn't it called like the White Horse or something like that?
Yeah, it's the White Horse, that, and it's out Dover way, but it's on that same ley line. And it feels very much to me, that place has always felt very much to me like what I think of as a wind point. There's a strong tradition in that area, especially along that ley line, of what I think of as weather witching, which is a derivative of dowsing. But where people are working on or working with elemental energy to do weather shifts, weather shifting. Mm-hmm. And the horse is very definitely a wind point where you're looking to shift storm dragon energy from like the channel and stuff like that.
So the White Horse, according to the Googles, is in Oxfordshire.
Okay.
I'm looking for Dover on the map, and I'm not seeing it.
Dover is sort of one of the outermost points on that peninsula that is to the east of Stonehenge.
So Oxford's like right in the middle of the island. Hmm. Well, south of the middle. Hey, they're south central. Look at that. Yeah. So Dover, because Cliffs of Dover. Hey, Eric Johnson. I connect things through musicians, sorry.
Hey, whatever works.
Yeah.
Music being the universal language.
Yeah.
Within a culture.
Now I'm totally distracted by Penzance being on the southern tip of that.
Speaking of music?
Yeah, I'm picturing pirates now. Okay, Dover's on the other side. So
it is?
It's actually almost directly opposite. Through kind of London into Oxford. It's like that makes kind of a line.
Okay.
But
do we want to talk about London being a PowerPoint, by the way?
Convergence?
Oh yeah.
Good.
I mean there's it's founded on a super magical point that it feels to me like the Romans absolutely knew about, and they were like, okay, Londinium here. It's a power source.
Well, Wiltshire is, unless I'm mixing things up, which could totally be the case, that's the province where Stonehenge is.
Okay.
So Stonehenge is kind of, let's see, that would be west, so kind of southwest, like south-southwest of London. If you're thinking of London as kind of a spoke, that totally works.
Yeah.
Between Stonehenge, Dover, and Oxford.
I love that southern England in my head is apparently dyslexic flipped. But yeah. Okay.
Which is funny, because I was toying with asking you about the origins of Tintagel, which is way over, closer to Penzance actually, but on the northern end of that western area there before I guess it's still part of the peninsula, but it's on the northern side, whereas Penzance is on the southern side, almost directly northwest of Plymouth. So for those who are unfamiliar, Tintagel would be where Camelot was supposed to be,
right?
Supposedly,
right?
Yeah. So I think we both, it's been on my brain a little bit longer, but we're both in England, apparently.
Yeah, right, there now. You go. So, I mean, the British Isles in general, you know, not just this side, but also Ireland and stuff, are filled, like, the percentage of power spots per landmass sort of thing is way higher than almost anywhere else on the planet. It's a really fascinating thing, and a large percentage of the Atlantean diaspora ended up in the Celtic Isles. I mean, they went some other places too, but a large percentage went there, and when you look at places like Camelot, when you look at places like Avalon, when you look at places like some of the Cairns, there are folks absolutely still there. They've just stepped sideways like they did in Chaco Canyon in the American Southwest. Those cultures still exist. They just didn't want to deal with the lower vibration bullshit. And so they stepped sideways and they're coexisting with us, but we don't see them. They just see us. And this is what gets attributed in a lot of spaces to like fey or fey energy. And for people who don't know, there's fairy energy or fey energy in pretty much every culture on the planet, at least those that are conscious of, you know, the energy of the land kind of stuff. It just shows up in different form, but there's, you know, it's elemental energy as expressed through beings. Hey, we're back to that being thing.
It's all a circle, man.
It's all a circle. Oh, and I just looked at my timer and we are totally out of time.
I was going to say, we're probably getting to that point. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you for joining us. This is What in the World, a podcast where we deal with all sorts of things esoteric, as you may have gathered. I am Ayama Natara. I have been with Dave Burke.
Hello.
And we will catch you next time. Thanks for joining us.